Well, hello there. Welcome to the story of us, from cosmic dawn to the depths of being. That's me. I'm Jeff Ellison. I'm your host. Thanks again for tuning in today. As you know, at the Story of Us and the Story of Us Project, we believe that from the first spark of the cosmos to the quiet pulse of a human heart, every story is part of one great unfolding, a tapestry woven from courage, from love, and sometimes from loss. Today's guest lives at the intersection of all three. Her name is Molly Cassaro Jones. She's my next door neighbor. She's my friend. And she's a woman whose story is stitched from generations of compassion and conviction. She's the daughter of two second-generation immigrants, one Italian, one Irish, whose family believed that to live well is to help others live better. Her grandfather in New York City during the Great Depression fought for the rights of renters who had been cast into the streets. Her mother, raising six children in Florida during the turbulent 1960s, refused to look away from injustice. When others stayed divided, her mom chose connection, bringing her children to the quote-unquote colored pool for swimming lessons, saying simply, "Because I can make this choice now." And her father, a professor at the University of Louisville, opened his classroom and opened his heart to Iranian students in the 1980s during the hostage crisis, offering a refuge in a time of suspicion. Molly grew up in that lineage of humanity, people who stand up when it would be easier to stand aside. She went on to earn degrees in industrial engineering and in law, but perhaps her greatest creation, which she calls her project, is her family. Five kids, each carrying forward that same legacy of both curiosity and courage. Jeff Jr., Jack, the twins Matt and Pete, and her youngest, Michelle. All of them engineers of one kind or another, of systems, of medicine, of the human spirit. But today, it's Pete's story that brings us here. Pete Jones, the lighthearted twin, the anchor for his friends, the one who made others laugh and feel seen. After earning his degree in mechanical engineering from the University of Alabama, he came home. And without warning, at just 23 years old, Pete chose to end his life. In the wake of that unthinkable loss, Molly and her family did something extraordinary. They took their grief, raw, incomprehensible, sacred, and they turned it into action. The very next day, the Pete Foundation was born. Its mission is to shine a light on youth mental health, to normalize the conversation, and to ensure that one feels they must face the darkness alone. Through community events, through education, art, and dialogue, the foundation has become a living tribute, and not just to Pete, but to every young person who needs to know that help is not weakness, and that vulnerability is a form of strength. As we begin our conversation today, I want you to consider these truths that I hope you find alarming, because I certainly did. One in five young people struggle with mental illness. That's 20% of all children in America today. Suicide is the second leading cause of death for those aged 10 to 34. Not automobile accidents, not cancer, not heart conditions. Suicide. And in Kentucky, suicides now outnumber homicides nearly 2 to 1. And unfortunately, that number just, it continues to grow. Statistics are one thing, but statistics are not stories. Stories are what give statistics a heartbeat. And Molly's story, her courage, her faith in humanity, her refusal to let despair have the final word, is a testament to the power of love to rebuild what's been broken. So as we step into this episode, I invite you to listen, not just with your ears, but listen with your heart. We absolutely must stop being afraid or embarrassed to talk about mental health and suicide. We have no choice. We must give our children's generations the words to describe how they feel and normalize talking about their mental wellness just as they would any other medical condition. We have to learn how to get past the simple, "Hey there, how was your day?" and dig deeper, no matter how uncomfortable it may be for us or for our kiddos. Parents need the courage to ask the tough questions. Things like, "Are you thinking of ending your life? And if so, have you thought about a plan?" These questions can make a huge difference, and they can possibly begin to save some precious lives. Molly shared with me that even if one person hears her story today and decides to reach out for help, she'll see that as a victory beyond measure. I believe all humans suffer, and especially if we're honest, we all suffer from mental health issues at some point in our story. Molly needs your help. Visit the Peat Foundation website at www.thepeatfoundation.org. Buy a flag. Fly it proudly. We're all in this together. And Pete, if you're out there somewhere in the universe, if you're listening, you can rest easy knowing that through your family's love and their fierce devotion to life, you've already helped to heal the world. You're certainly making an impact on humanity. Let's listen to Molly's story. Molly, thanks for joining me this afternoon.
I'm so glad to be here, Jeff.
You know, I tell you what, it's amazing. We've been neighbors for over 7 years now and been very friendly and known a little of your story, but shame on me for having to have a podcast to get you to come over and have some of Jessica's delicious white chicken chili here this afternoon on a cold late October night.
Shame on me for not having you over.
Well, it goes both ways. That's true, but we're all busy these days, and that's part of the story of us. And I'm really excited to share your story with the world. As you know, on our podcast, we're really focused on people understanding that forever, for the life of humanity, stories have mattered. Yes. They've been an important part of humanity, and it's a lost art that we've lost, right? So let's dig into it. Tell us the story of Molly Casero-Jones.
Where do you want me to start?
Well, I know a little bit of it. So you were born in Los Angeles.
Yes.
And lived in Florida during the 1960s.
That's exactly right.
So tell me a little bit more about your parents, maybe your ancestors, where you're from. What was growing up? What was it growing up in Florida in the 1960s like, kind of thing?
It was idyllic. From my perspective, my memory, stepping back to my parents. So my dad is second generation American. Both of his parents' grandparents were from Italy. On my mom's side, her father immigrated from Ireland, and her mother's parents had immigrated from Ireland. So very Irish family on one side, very Italian family on the other side. They were born and raised in New York City. They turned 18, they got married, and got out of the city and said they'd never go back. They went back to visit, but they never went back to live. So my dad traveled around getting his education. He got a bachelor's degree in upstate New York, got a master's degree in California, and went to Florida to work on his PhD. And so that explains me being born in California, but living in Florida for the 60s.
Now, your dad was really active in politics in New York City when he was there, right?
Actually, not my dad, my grandfather, my mom's dad. He was the one from Ireland. He had come over as a young man, and he was very active in politics. He was active in the Democratic Party, who at that time they were very involved in helping people who were being dispossessed from their apartments, their homes. And back in that day, there were no renter's rights. You didn't pay your rent, the landlord came and all your stuff was out on the street and you had no right to anything. So he was very active in helping those families.
Wow. Fantastic. That was also during the Depression.
It was during the Depression, yeah, which really, I think the Depression formed my mother more than my father. She was always very thrifty as I was growing up, and that was good for me. It's good to see what being thrifty looks like.
Yeah, sure. And when you guys were growing up in Florida, you had told me some stories about the work that your mom and dad both did in really being advocates for people who, needed help, right? And I think that started with your grandfather in New York City, helping displaced people during the Depression. But that carried forward in your mom and dad and the life that you lived in Florida. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, it did. So in Florida, what was going on then in the 60s was the segregation. And then, of course, the Equal Rights Amendment that was passed. And I remember my mother being very vocal in terms of just the neighborhood and our community and making sure that people understood the importance of the Equal Rights Amendment. And they always knew that that's what she was going to talk about. And I remember after it passed, and I was just pretty young, and summertime came around, and she signed us up at the local swimming pool again. But this year, we were signed up at the, quote, colored people's swimming pool. And that's where we went, and we took our swim lessons, and we swam for the day. Any day that we went, we're going to go to the pool. That's the pool that we went to. It was a public pool, but that's the one that we joined. And the man who ran it said, I looked at her and said, why are you coming to this pool? Why are you signing your children up for swim lessons at this pool? And she said, because I can. And because prior to the Equal Rights Amendment, we couldn't swim at that pool, and the children from that pool couldn't swim at the whites' pool. And so she wanted to integrate them. And I remember those lessons, and I remember really vividly my swim teacher was a young man. He was Black, and I was scared. I was scared of the water. I wasn't scared of being at that pool, but I was scared of the water. I didn't know how to swim. And I remember him picking me up and carrying me out into the water and helping me as I learned to do the strokes. And I think back about that now, and I wish I could talk to him and say, what did that feel like for you? Because it's probably the first time he had picked up a little white girl. I don't know. For me, it felt safe. I wonder what it felt like for him. It's just a neat memory.
It's a beautiful memory. Mm-hmm. And I think it's something that you've learned to take with you, yeah, put in your pocket and carry forward to other people in your life. And your dad moved you guys to Louisville, Kentucky. That's how you made it to Louisville.
That's right. That's right. And the neat thing, I remember when he was trying to sell us on the idea of moving to Louisville, Kentucky, he said, oh, it's great. Every house there has a basketball goal above the garage door.
That was the selling point.
That was it.
The basketball
plus
goal.
Plus Kentucky Fried Chicken.
Oh, okay. Well, two things we're still very, very proud of.
Right.
Here in Kentucky. Right. But he was a professor at Louisville's Speed School.
That's right.
Tell us a little bit about Speed School, because this started a tradition that carries forward for many generations on both you and your husband's side as well. So for those people who might be listening from wherever, tell those about the rich history and tradition of the Speed School here in Louisville.
Okay. Yeah. Well, Speed School it's named Speed Scientific School. It's the engineering school at the University of Louisville, and it's actually named after the Speed family, who were good friends with Abraham Lincoln.
Oh, okay. I learned something
new.
You
didn't know that. Yeah.
I didn't know that.
It's that Speed family, and our Speed Museum is the same Speed family. So there's a museum that's not an engineering museum, but there's a museum on Louisville's campus, And it's that Speed family that was good friends with Abraham Lincoln.
Wow. The story of the Cassaro side of the family seems like it is a rich history of people helping other people. People knocking down barriers, whether that's barriers created by poverty or barriers created by race. But you tell the story of some of your father's students at the Speed School.
Right. So he was teaching at Speed School in civil engineering, and this was in the 70s and 80s. Well, he was there 70s, 80s, 90s. But in the 80s, the U.S. got into very bad relations with Iran. It's when the Shah got kicked out, and they held a lot of Americans hostage over in Iran for a long period of time. So Americans really disliked Iranians. Prior to that hostage situation, a lot of Iranians had come over to the U.S. to study. And we had a pretty good number here in Louisville, even though we're in the center of the country. A lot of them had come to our engineering school. And so it was hard for those students. When you get to the master's level, you have to find a professor that's going to work closely with you on your master's work. And it was hard for them to find a professor that they could work closely with, at least in civil engineering. I'm not talking about the other branches of engineering. And so my father became the go-to person, and he saw these Iranian students like any other students, and they needed that mentor and that professor that was going to help them get their education. And they really treasured him for viewing them as a student wanting to learn. And they're good friends with us still. They stayed friends with my dad until he passed. That's kind of a neat relationships.
Well, you should be really proud of your heritage. Just hearing this, and this is just scratches the surface. I'm sure there's, you know, hours worth of family conversation that we can record and pass on to the next generations. But to me, just distilling it down to the quick part of your story, it really resonates with me that the fabric that's woven through your family, it feels like people helping people. People not being afraid and having the courage to stand up and do what they believe is right and pass that on to the next generation.
Right.
And I think that that really resonates for me in your story. And you just, you know, you shine with that legacy.
It's valuing people. And you say it weaving a fabric, it creates a comfortable fabric.
Oh, I like that. Mm-hmm. I like that. Yeah. Yeah. And so you started your college career at the University of Louisville.
That's right.
While your father was a professor there.
Correct.
And then continued on to Speed School yourself.
That's right? Correct. Yes.
So you are a civil engineer.
No, I'm an industrial engineer.
Industrial engineer.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Mm-hmm. And then tell us a little bit more about how that all came about.
Well, I was going to school. I was going to U of L. I didn't like what I was studying. I told my dad, I'm just not having any fun with this. I don't like it. He said, come over to Speed School and just take this one class and see what you think. And it was a low-level engineering class, and I took it and loved it. And I never looked back. So I got my bachelor's degree. And then from there, I went over and got my law degree because, the truth be told, my whole goal, I wanted to become a lawyer, and I needed a bachelor's degree to get into law school.
So interested in industrial engineering, but that was never really the goal. The goal was that you wanted to be in law.
That's true. But in the end, I became an engineer.
Oh. What did you think attracted you to wanting to be a lawyer?
To be honest, I think it was watching Perry Mason.
Yeah, okay. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, it's exciting.
I was intrigued by that.
Courtroom
drama. I thought it would
drama.
Be interesting. Yeah. The study of law is extremely interesting, and I loved it. I loved going to law school.
Yeah, I bet.
Mm-hmm.
I bet. Everyone in your family feels like education has been something that you cherish, you love, and you did a lot of. Right. Yeah. We got to hear your husband, Jeff's story over dinner. We're going to have to get him on the show because that's just fascinating. it was a light bulb that went off for me. I'm living next door to a descendant of Leonardo da Vinci. When you hear the stories that he tells, it's just really, really remarkable. Now, we skipped over this part, but I know you have at least one brother because I've had the privilege of meeting him. Any other siblings?
Yes, I actually have three brothers and two sisters.
Are they here in Louisville?
They're all here in Louisville.
Mm-hmm. And what did they do with their careers?
With their careers, let's see. I guess four of us went into engineering.
Okay.
Two of us went on to law school from engineering. One went on to medical school from engineering. Sister went on to, she went to business school, and my brother, he went to U of L for a few years, but he was a guy that had too much energy and too much capability to stay there.
But what's the rest of that story? How did that turn out?
It turned out well for him. Yeah. He's just been doing it. He worked in the restaurant industry for a while and had owned some of his own businesses. And he's just kind of been one of those guys that's been involved in a lot of different things and enjoyed it.
We touched on a little bit over dinner, but tell me a little bit more about how you and Jeff met. Cause I think it was while that you were both at U of L.
Right. We were both at U of L in our undergraduate studies, and my sister, who was also in engineering school, she was in class with Jeff. And so that's how we met, just maybe running into each other in the library or maybe out. I think it was actually, we were out with a bunch of engineering friends and she ran into Jeff and that's how we met.
Wow. And when did you guys get married?
Got married in 1983.
Wow. So... you guys are the smarty pants. So 42 years of marriage. Yeah. Did I do the math right? Is that right?
Is that right? I think that's right.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. Okay. So want to get into a little bit about family life, mm-hmm. right? So you guys have a large family.
We
that
do.
You and Jeff have started large family, mm-hmm. right? And so tell me about the kiddos.
So the kiddos, I always refer to them as one of my projects because we have five children and they're less than 5 years apart. So it's like,
whoa.
In those years, that's what we were doing.
Yeah.
Was having babies. So we have.
And going to law school and going to medical school.
I was finished with school. I was working and Jeff was in medical school. Those were almost the 5 years of. Medical school, residency rather, I should say his residency. So we have four boys and then one girl. And yeah, when my daughter was born, our oldest son was four.
Wow.
So it's crazy. Yeah. But it was good. You know, we were always doing one thing. We had one age group moving through, just a lot of them.
Passing clothes down.
Yeah.
It was as good you were for going. That. Yeah. I remember Jessica and I talked about that because our kids are a year and 2 weeks apart. We only have the two, Brady and Peyton.
So still that's close.
Very close. But we just kind of were in that groove
mm-hmm.
for a couple of years and it worked.
And then when you're out of the groove, you're out. You don't go back into it.
Yeah.
And that's what happened with us. Now, let me step back. I did say, there were five of them in less than 4 years, but there's a little cheating that happened in there. We had a set of twins.
Oh.
So that always say that runs the numbers up.
It does. Don't twins run in the family?
No.
So that was a surprise.
No, it was a huge surprise. It was out of nowhere. But the funny thing about it is my sister, who I had gone through engineering school with, she ended up having, so I have twin boys. She had twin boys 6 months after mine were born. And that's it. It does not run in the family. I mean, maybe we made it start running, but beforehand it didn't. So that was crazy.
That is crazy.
Mm-hmm.
Whoa. Yeah. Okay. So let's go through each one of the kids because you have to be so very proud. I've had the opportunity to casually run into all of them and they're mm-hmm. such wonderful people. But okay. So who was the first?
Was Jeff Jr.
Jeff Jr. Mm-hmm. And Jeff now is in his residency?
He's doing a fellowship in orthopedic trauma at UK.
Mm-hmm. So just like Jeff Sr.
Just like Jeff Sr. And Jeff Jr. did, he went to engineering school, got his master or his bachelor's and master's in mechanical engineering, and then went to medical school.
Wow. And so where is he now?
He's at UK.
He's at UK?
Yeah, he's doing the fellowship at UK.
Okay.
Yep.
Then who came next?
Jack came next.
Jack.
John Michael Jones, but we call him Jack.
John Michael Jones. I love it. It rolls off the tongue. It's beautiful.
And he...
But he's not a Tom. And he's not a Mike.
He's not a Tom or a Mike.
Okay.
No. So he got his degree in mechanical engineering. I'm going to be repeating myself about that a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And then he was working for a local company as a mechanical engineer, but he quit just about a year ago. And he's now going back to speed school, engineering school, for a master's in computer science. And he's loving every minute of it.
That's great. And that's what you ultimately want, right? Is you want mm-hmm. to see your kids just thrive and
yeah.
do something that they really are really passionate
right.
about.
Right. He loves it. And it's something that he talked about doing for a long time. And then as time goes, you think, well, you're never going to do it. You're never going to do it. But I'm so happy that he took that plunge a year ago.
He did. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. And then who was next?
Next was actually Matt and Pete.
Matt and Pete, the identical
the
twins.
Identical twins. Yeah. Matt being the oldest one. Matt also has his degree in mechanical engineering and he's working as a mechanical engineer. He's a manager at the same company where Jack worked. But Jack has moved on.
Well, it's great that you have Jeff and Jack real close to home.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I have Matt and Jack close to home. Jeff is in
Matt
Lexington.
And Jack, but Jeff's in UK. But
he's at UK,
close.
But that's pretty close because you know what? He used to be in El Paso, Texas.
Okay.
So yeah. It's very close compared to El Paso.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And then let's tell the story of Pete.
The story of Pete. So Pete actually went to the University of Alabama. And he got his degree in mechanical engineering.
Surprise, surprise.
I know. And then following his degree, he returned here to Louisville. And he was working on a master's in industrial engineering. And he and Matt were talking about, you know, going in business together. And their big passion was brewing beer. They did a lot of beer brewing. And they were... kind of looking at that and maybe even getting some formal education in it before they open a business. But Pete suffered from depression and we only discovered that after he returned back to Louisville from his undergraduate degree at Alabama and he ended his life.
Yeah. And at what age was he?
23
years old. So
yeah,
that was a difficult time.
Very hard.
Yeah.
Very, very hard.
I want to talk more about that. I think that you have turned your family's legacy and your suffering and what you and Jeff went through in that experience into something really, really positive. Before we do that, I want to talk about Michelle a little bit.
Michelle.
Female's your youngest.
Yeah. The poor little girl raised by four brothers. She's really a wonderful person, as they all are. She also has her undergraduate degree in mechanical engineering. She went on to medical school like her older brother, and she's currently doing a residency in OBGYN in El Paso, Texas.
Okay, so she's in El Paso.
She is in El Paso, yes.
Wow. So I wanted you were gracious enough to talk to us a little bit today. On this podcast, I have talked about my family's struggles with mental health mm-hmm. and our son, who's just about to turn 23, mm-hmm. A time in Pete's life that you know, was very difficult for him as
yes.
well. And so I'm very grateful that you had the courage and have stepped up to kind of tell Pete's story, but also want to tell the audience about all the work that you're doing in the Pete Foundation, how that started, the seeds of that, and some of the work that you guys are doing. So can we talk a little bit about more about Pete as a young man? Him and Matt were really close.
They were very close. Yeah, they were really good friends. Pete was very outgoing, very friendly. He had a great sense of humor, and he had a way of making everybody around him comfortable. He was kind of the rock for his friends. If they were having a bad day, things weren't going their way, maybe they were suffering a breakup with a girlfriend, Pete was the one that they would seek out because he could help make them feel better.
Yeah. Yeah. And so knowing that, when did you first identify that Pete was having some struggles?
Well, I had said he finished his undergraduate, came back here, and he was working on a master's in industrial engineering, and he stopped going to classes. It was probably in about January of 2016, and that wasn't like Pete because he had 4.0 from Alabama, so he was really smart. He was serious about his education. He didn't do things like miss homework and not go to class, and he wasn't going to class. And so I said, Pete, why are you not going to class? What's wrong? Is something wrong? And he said, yes, I'm depressed. And I said, did something happen? Did something happen to make you depressed? And he said, no, I've been this way my whole life. And that was the first indication that I had that Pete was struggling in any way. And so I asked him right away, are you willing to get help to see somebody? And he said, yes. So I had a friend who was able to help me figure out where he could go to get some help. Got him in with a psychiatrist who's a really good psychiatrist here in town. Pete really liked his doctor. He was good about going to his appointments. Everything, you know, we were working on him and him getting better, and he was on medication. And, you know, it took a while. It takes a while with the medication to figure out what's the right thing. Meanwhile, I was, you know, being very cognizant of Pete and what he might need and trying to make sure he was okay. And he and I took a couple trips, little road trips, you know, just spending some time together. And he did kind of feel like, you know, I'm feeling better. I'm getting better. And he was making plans to go back to school. But in December of that year, he ended his life.
That had to have been a tremendous shock to you and your family.
It's unbelievable. It's a shock. I mean, you can't explain it.
It's
unbelievable.
So what was the first flicker of the Pete Foundation? Maybe that moment when you knew your family story could become someone else's lifeline, maybe.
Well, it was actually the very next day. So, of course, all the kids were home at the house. Nobody was living out of town at that time. And they were all at the house. You know, we were all together, and we stayed all together for quite a long time after we lost Pete. But and we were in the kitchen, and we were just talking and just talking about Pete and what a wonderful person he was. And my kids, and I remember especially my oldest son and Michelle speaking up and saying, we got to do something. If this happens to somebody like Pete, this is happening to good people everywhere, every day. You know, I was amazed. I wasn't looking outside the walls of our house yet, but my kids immediately did. They're like, no, this is more than what's happening in our home. And I told them if they want to do something, I would support them. And here we are.
So the kids kind of came up with the original idea that you could do something special to honor not just Pete, but also get a message out.
Yeah.
And what did the message become? What is the message of the Pete Foundation?
The message of the Pete Foundation is to rally communities to champion mental health and advocate for education, wellness, and care.
Yeah, and one of the messages that's really resonated with me that feels very meaningful is this idea of stopping the stigma mm-hmm. around mental mm-hmm. health. Right. And I think that's something that my wife and I have talked about a lot, is that sharing our journey, sharing our experiences has been so powerful for others. And one of the reasons I wanted to share your story on the podcast, and it's because it does feel like there's this stigma around right. mental health, that there are so many more people that are suffering silently mm-hmm. behind the scenes mm-hmm. and are afraid to talk about it. Have right. you learned why that is?
Well, I have my theory about why that is. And I think it's because we're afraid of mental illness. We're afraid of suicide. And because we're afraid of it, we don't explore it to try to understand it. And we don't talk about it. So we need to get rid of that fear. We need to realize it's just another health condition. And we should be talking about it. We should be exploring knowledge and exploring information. I mentioned when I found out that Pete was struggling and he needed to get care, that I felt lucky that I knew somebody that I could ask, hey, do you know a psychiatrist? Do you know somebody that I could that could help Pete? Some people don't know anyone they can ask. You know, I mean, it's not like if you're going to get braces for your child and you can ask a coworker, oh, where did you get braces for your child? You know, we don't do that. You don't ask a coworker, oh, what counselor is your child seeing? And it's just because we're afraid of it. So, yeah, we do have to get rid of the stigma. It's nothing to be afraid of. It's just normal health care. At the Pete Foundation, we're working really hard. We've kind of gotten to the point where it's like, okay, we're not just focusing on getting rid of the stigma. We're going to focus on the work that needs to be done in mental health care. Because once we're doing that work, the stigma goes away. Once mental health screenings are commonplace, once your doctor is readily telling you, oh, here, I think I'm going to have you go see this counselor, or I'm going to suggest that you go see this counselor, it's going to be commonplace and we're not going to be afraid of it. We're going to understand it. There'll be more research done, more care options.
And it feels really important because you do focus on youth mental health. Mm-hmm. But early intervention seems key here, right? Opening up that dialogue at a young age seems really vital to changing right. the future.
Right.
One of the things that that I've learned in our journey is that just like with being a parent, they don't give you the manual.
Right.
And what would you want other parents to know when they see those first early signs?
To explore it, to seek help, to seek understanding about it. What I want them to know is that there is, on average, an 11-year gap between the onset of mental health symptoms and the beginning of care. 11 years for a deadly disease. We don't want that. We don't want that with any disease, especially a deadly one. And Pete fit that 11-year gap. And it's not because I wasn't willing to help him. It's because I never understood that that was something he was suffering from. And from Pete's perspective, he probably never had the words to describe it. But that's because our society doesn't offer up those words. We don't raise children to understand how to describe how they're feeling and how they might be suffering. So that's why we like to focus on youth, because we really need to give them the language.
Yeah. And one of your missions is to normalize the topic of mental health. But
right.
In your opinion, what conversations still feel the hardest for families to have now that you've been doing this for a while and you've worked with a lot of others that have sought help from the Peat Foundation and shared their stories with the Peat Foundation, but which of those conversations do you think that families still really struggle with are the hardest ones?
I think just kind of getting past the, hey, are you doing okay today? Is anything bothering you? But maybe being able to go a little bit deeper into what's making you feel good, what's making you not feel good, and what does it feel like when you're not having a good day? Give me some good words for that. And I will say we do a lot of trainings for suicide prevention, and something that is really, really, really hard for people to say is to ask another person, are you thinking of ending your life? Or are you thinking of suicide? Are you thinking of killing yourself? And that shouldn't be so hard to say. Now, not that we need to be asking our children that by any means, but if we were more comfortable asking that question to somebody who's clearly suffering, we become more comfortable talking about mental health and emotional health.
For those that are building the courage to have to ask that question, mm-hmm. that most difficult question,
yeah.
and they're scared of what the answer might be.
Right.
If they hear an answer of, yes, mom or dad, I have thought of that. Mm-hmm. What is the foundation teaching those parents on what to do next?
Well, the next thing that I would say to do is ask, have you ever thought of a plan? Because it's important to know that. Because if they have thought of a plan, then you know that they're that much closer. And it's important to know how close they are, even though we don't want to think that somebody's at all close to ending their life or to suicide, attempting suicide, but we have to know. And so once you get that feeling, what I would say for everybody is call 988. 988 is there for everybody, and they can help you figure out what next step to take. 988 in Louisville is answered locally by Seven Counties. Seven Counties also has a crisis unit. So they will actually come out with this unit. It's a van, maybe similar to like an ambulance, but it's not an ambulance. They will actually sit in there and provide some counseling and therapy for the person who's struggling as they figure out next steps. So I would say if your child has said yes to that question, you really need to get immediate help.
Yeah. I think part of stopping the stigma is knowing the facts. And I think the facts are buried. I don't think they're talked about enough.
Right.
I went to the Peat Foundation website, which is a remarkable resource for young people, their families, anyone who wants to learn more information about this. And the statistics were really striking to me. I wrote down a couple, and some of this data is a little bit old. I think there's not really good data around mental health, suicide, suicide prevention, et cetera. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I think maybe if I recall this data, maybe 8 years old, that is,
we need to update that.
Which we sure do, don't we?
I can give you some updated data from my head. What do you have?
Well, so what I have is 1 in 8 kids have depression.
Oh, that's probably closer to 1 in 5.
Yeah, I would think that some of the topics we've talked about on this podcast have been collective illusion around social media, mm-hmm. the pressures on these kids growing up in an environment that includes a lot of disinformation, misinformation, social media, having to navigate all of those things. And I think that those things are making this problem so much worse.
Yes.
And it's becoming something that we no longer have a choice but to address, and address very quickly mm-hmm. with passionate people like you and smart people. So so closer to 20% of all children suffer from some form of depression.
Yes, or mental illness.
Or mental illness. Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Second leading cause of death in 10 to 34-year-olds?
Suicide.
Number two.
That's
between 10 and 34-year-olds. This is, I think sometimes people are data-driven, and we're not hearing enough about this. the second leading cause of death of children between the age of 10 and 34 is not car accidents. It's not, you know, it's not any of the things you would imagine, but it is suicide.
Right. Suicides exceed homicides in Kentucky.
In fact, I think the data that was on the website was almost twice as many suicides as homicides and growing.
Yeah.
We have got the work that you're doing is so remarkable. It's so important. And you're doing such a professional and passionate job around it. That has these stats have to be out there and they have to be part of the conversation, because until people can know about them, I don't think they're going to, they understand the complexity and the seriousness of the issue.
Right.
And it's great people like you guys that are, have the courage to stand up and say, we can't tolerate not talking about this issue anymore. This is not something that we have to be, afraid of or embarrassed about.
That's right.
And, it's amazing. One of the things I love about it too, is you guys have like everything I know that your family does, you guys have really dug in and taken this, as far as you can take it, you're taking it. The mental health flag that you created, you've got the pen on here.
Yeah.
That initiative is so beautifully symbolic. It really is. Tell me how that idea came about creating the flag and the colors and things.
We felt like we had to move the topic of mental health into public spaces. And you do that visually. You do that with visual components. And then you follow it with the words. And so that's why we felt like we had to do that. There had to be a visual component. And their mental health flags are flown in all 50 states, many foreign countries. We just mailed one to Sweden just yesterday. We're getting orders for them from all over the world.
Wow. And so you can order those flags right on the Pete Foundation website.
That's right. There are some other flag websites that sell those as well. So we don't hold any kind of rights to that design. It's public domain.
Which is even more beautiful.
Yeah.
And I think that there's got to be emotions that stir in you when you drive down the road and you start seeing these flags.
Yeah.
And it feels like that's one thing that people can do is to stop the stigma, is to promote it proudly.
That's right.
That they believe that there needs to be a path forward here.
And you talk about driving down the road. So the state actually adopted a license plate. I think it's been out maybe just a little bit less than a year now, with the mental health flag on it, promoting mental health. So it's one of the
how great
plates that you can get. You know how you can get a U of L, UK plate, you can get a mental health plate.
Yeah. And you guys do some really cool other things too, from Chalk the Walk to Rock the Elephant and the Stomp Music Festival.
Right.
These programs are about art. They're about community. They're about education. I'm curious, what role do you think the creativity or music and these things play in the healing for
youth?
Plays
a big role. Plays a big role. Art and music are known to be... Art, music, and writing or journaling are significant forms for healing and mental health and for therapy. And, you know, with music from the very beginning, we started the Pete Foundation, and right away we knew we were going to do a music festival, and it just seemed right because music is often a refuge. You know, when you're not feeling that good and you want to listen to something that's going to help you feel better, you turn to music oftentimes.
And when I first, I love music. It's healing for me too. And I think that, if we're all honest, I think that part of the human story and what connects us as humans is not only that, regardless of who we are, if we are a human being in today's environment, we suffer.
Yeah.
We all suffer. Yes. But also, it's not just the suffering, but it's the ability to move beyond that, right?
Right.
That I think is really, really important. But I think that if we're all honest, we all suffer, but we all suffer from mental health issues from time to time.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
I think that it's only part of being human. And I feel like the message that you guys are sending is that early intervention, mm-hmm. talking about these issues,
right,
getting them out in the open, and destigmatizing the conversation around them so that children and their loved ones can have open, honest dialogue and some facts and a little bit of education of what this means can make such a tremendous impact.
It can make a huge difference, yes.
What do you think, put you on the spot, what do you think now that of what you've known about mental health, how do we stop the graph from growing so rapidly? You know, the statistics that we just shared, just 8 years old, are so stale that it's gone from 1 in 8 children that suffer from mental health or depression issues to 1 in 5. What is one impactful thing you think we can do to turn that around and start seeing that those statistics drop?
Okay, if you're going to limit me to one, I'll accept that.
No, I tell you what.
But let me say the one. Let me say one.
Okay.
That we can all do is we can all get the training that I referenced for suicide prevention. It's called QPR, which stands for Question, Persuade, Refer. The Peet Foundation provides that training for free because we believe in it so strongly. And we will train a group from size 1 to 100. And what it will do is get rid of the stigma. It will open the conversation. It will open the desire in all of us to explore this whole issue of mental health, mental illness. And that will make the biggest difference. Now, following that, we do need some differences within the healthcare industry so that there are more treatment options and that they're more readily available and that there's, you know, the cost component can be addressed also.
We talked a little bit over this, over dinner. Mm-hmm. Being in healthcare myself, it is apparent to people that work in healthcare, but it's got to start becoming apparent to just about every American that the healthcare system is broken. Mm-hmm. And part of that is just not having enough resources. Right. And so I know your foundation is working on things like state and federal legislation.
Yeah.
Can you talk a little bit about some of those initiatives?
Well, I better not talk about it too much since it is in the infancy, but we are working with at the state level, the legislature to try to get some action so that we can improve the healthcare system around mental health and make it more accessible to everybody.
Yeah.
To everybody.
Yeah. And there's a lot of work that has to do, but it is very apparent to me that you guys started in the first place and it's, before we can do this work, we have to normalize being able mm-hmm. to have reasonable mm-hmm. conversations around this topic, and we have to get awareness out of the real serious problem that it is.
Right. Yeah.
What's next for the Peet Foundation?
What's next? Oh, we have some big plans, but they're like
maybe too soon to tell.
Yeah, it's okay. A little too soon to tell, but hopefully when they pan out, you'll be like, "That's what she wasn't telling us."
Mm-hmm. Okay, that's good. Well, more to come. Something for us to lean into the next time that we talk.
I'm sure you'll be leaning over the property line. Hey, Molly, any more news on that?
I'm dialed in. I can't. You know, I can't wait to see how far you guys take it because it's still in its infancy. I mean, you started this really early.
We started right away.
After Pete took his life, and it's been a couple of years now, and you've already made such a tremendous difference. I can't wait to see what the Pete Foundation looks like 6 or 7 years from now, and I really can't wait to revisit that and those statistics and really see the impact that you're making.
Yeah.
One of the questions that I ask all of my guests, I'm going to flip it around just a little bit. Typically, I ask a lot of my guests, because the part of what I'm doing here is recording these stories and these messages for eternity. Mm-hmm. And I feel like it's really cool that eventually you'll be able to listen to this 5, 10 years from now. And one of the questions is, You know, I always ask people, what do you want that version of you to know? But I'm going to flip it around a little bit.
Okay.
Pete tragically ended his life when you were 45 years old, and he was 23 years old. Looking back on...
I think I was 55.
55 years old.
Okay.
55 years old. I'm really bad with
I probably looked my facts. 45.
Okay. Absolutely, you did. 100%. What would you want to tell that version of yourself?
Thank you. That it was good.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it made a difference. And I'll tell you something. This is hard for me to say. But, you know, when we lost Pete, he left us a note. And I won't go over the whole thing, but toward the end, he said that he wanted to donate his body to science. If we could, he wanted to donate his body to science. If we couldn't, that was okay. But, quote, I want to help mankind. That was his last statement. And so that's who Pete was. As much as he was suffering, you've got to be suffering an awful lot to say, I can't stay in this life. But he still wanted to help mankind. And so I hope that I look back and can tell that self, because of who Pete was and how he lived his life, we carried it forward and he helped mankind through our work.
I really appreciate you sharing that with me.
Yeah.
That means a lot. And just hearing your story for the first time tonight, Pete came honestly by that.
Yeah.
In his own way, he was a little bit of a helper too.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
He was, yeah.
And I think just telling your story, and I hope that people are listening, they're going to be affected by this, and you've made a big impact on at least one or two listeners tonight. And we talked about this a little bit earlier. I know your goal was, I want to donate my time to you tonight, Jeff, because my goal is if one person,
right,
hears the message,
right,
here's the story of Pete, here's the story of you and your family, and it makes an impact. It gets them to the right care that they need. It gets them, it helps them heal a little bit. Whatever that message is, helping mankind and that one person at a time.
Right.
It's really beautiful. And I'm very grateful and very gracious that you took the time to tell us that story. We have a few minutes left and I want to talk about a few other things, if that's okay.
Okay.
One of the things that you told me in some of our prep was that, like your family, that you see that we are here on earth for a very short time.
Mm-hmm.
That people came before us and there'll be many that come after us. And all of those people that came before us felt that their time here was what mattered and that their time was the most important time in the history of the world, et cetera. But can you expand on those a little bit? I think, honestly, this is this message of really understanding how fleeting our time is here.
Yeah. Yeah.
Can you expand on that a little bit more?
Well, some people may hear that and think, oh, what a sad outlook. So we're unimportant, or what's our purpose? But I look at it different. I look at it as though I am here for a short time in the history of the world. And that, so therefore, the time I'm here is not about me. It's about being a part of this world. And it's about enjoying my time here and doing what good I can. And the good doesn't have to be, you know, major things, big inventions, or, you know, anything astronomical. Just being good. Just being good to your neighbor. Just being good to the other members of your family, being good to your pets, just being good to yourself. that's why we're here. And we should value that and appreciate that reason for being here.
I agree. 100%. Kind of in closing, I ask you in your life experience, if there were certain truths that kind of held up over time, no matter where or when, mm-hmm. but you kind of went back to them over your whole life. And maybe we call this the Molly's mantra, right? but let's talk a little bit about my truth is that you said truth wins out and so does good.
Oh yeah. It goes back to what I just said about why we're here. We're here for a short time. And yeah, truth is going to win out. If it wins after my lifetime, it wins. It's going to win out. So why not live a truth? And good wins, I believe. So live good and live a truth.
Well said. I hope you're right. I feel like that's something that we're really struggling with right now in humanity is digging through all of the noise to find the truth. But I believe it's people like you that have faith that the truth still lies beneath all of the rubbish.
Right.
And I think that what divides us is far less than what keeps us together.
Completely true.
And humans are more good than what we give ourselves credit for.
I agree. Yes.
Molly, I want to thank you again for taking time on a dark, dreary Wednesday night to come over. I'm glad we did it.
Yeah, it's fun.
I'm glad to call you a friend.
Yes.
And I want all the listeners to know that if this is something that resonates, you can go to the Peat Foundation website. Let's remind them of the web address.
The peatfoundation.org.
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 I've been to the website. It's an incredible resource. And I want to thank you again. So, Pop Molly, peace be with you.
Thank you. Thank you so much for this opportunity.